Testing, testing.
Recording?
Yep.
Right?
Yep, I think so.
Does it tell you how many minutes you're in?
17 seconds so far.
Yeah, okay.
Good. So everyone's been here before, yes? Okay, I guess not everyone's met me though. My name's Roland Cohen, and I'm an old dog. What we call an old dog in our community. You know, old dogs, when they have dreams, they just kind of go like this. Like that. So, and they just sort of sit and watch things, you know. That's the ideal. That's the ideal old dog. So I thought a useful topic tonight would be to talk about the path, what we call the path, the path. And sometimes our teacher, Trigyen Trungpa, said the path is the goal. And so what does it mean when we're going about our lives to have a path, like when we're in the middle of work, in the middle of home, in the middle of family, in the middle of friends, in the middle of enemies. This is all considered part of the path, when we have a path. So the question is, what does it mean to have a path? And so from the point of view of our tradition, it's really a matter of sitting meditation, doing that, receiving instructions on how to do that, studying about basically what is going on here with meditation, but also about what is it that we do most of the time that creates a world of chaos and confusion. What do we actually do that perpetuates that? So it's understanding that whole process. All of this is the path. Understanding the process of confusion. And the only way to understand it is to do it, because we're already doing it. And we can actually see how it works. When we fully see how it works, that's called liberation. Fully seeing how confusion works, what it is, how we do it, how we perpetuate it, how we believe in that we're going to fix things when, in fact, we are usually making them worse or perpetuating suffering for ourselves and others. So, the amazing thing about the path, from my point of view, is that there is one. There is actual instructions on how to navigate this madness of a world which seems to really perpetuate, like force us, it almost seems to force us into further protection of ourselves, further kind of looking for some kind of temporary havens, looking for some kind of temporary pleasures, because it's so intense and it's so demanding to survive for some of us. And if it isn't demanding to survive, that in itself becomes a challenge of not becoming just completely kind of lazy and just lost in another way, in the sense of just giving into entertainment and just going along and not really caring. So there's all kinds of ways that we can get lost. So the nature of this path, it's quite extraordinary that there are instructions that if you just follow those instructions and really do it, you progress, you wake up, you start to see the whole enchilada and how it works. Now, that's called an authentic path. There are lots of paths that might say will help you in this way or that way. And there are lots of paths that actually do bring you to various kinds of fruitions. So the question is, what is this path? about? Why? What is this path leading to? And that's what's so extraordinary. This path leads to what we call, well, it leads to two things from the point of view of our journey here, our tradition. It leads to unsurpassable, complete, great enlightenment. It also leads to the creation of enlightened society, which enables people to realize unsurpassable, complete, great enlightenment. So that's this path. Those are the fruitions of this path. And so everything that we study, everything that we do, if we have studied this path, then every step we take is a forward step. It's a step of relating with the confusion that and how we create it, how we perpetuate it. Every single step becomes the path. That's the whole point. So it pervades our whole life if we soak ourselves in it. And that's a big if. That's a big if. A lot of us want to dip our toe in it because we really kind of like certain things, want to hold on to certain aspects of things that we feel we've already got it together and we want to keep it. We want to keep our comfort zones, but then we want to progress in some way. So we have some partial idea of how we would like to progress. And then it all becomes very tricky. Because really the path is very penetrating. The path, when you really get into it, it cuts you to the quick. It cuts through all of the projections, all of the ideas that are actually made up about what's going on. That's why it leads to unsurpassable great enlightenment, or complete reality, because it doesn't stop. It goes all the way. And so if we only want to go part of the way, you know, which we all do, whether we know it or not, we want to hold on to certain aspects of things that are comfortable. Then we end up kind of going, is this for me? You know, oh, I need to take a break from practice. And then we lose track of the path. That's what happens. And there's lots of other reasons that we lose track of the path. We, for whatever reason, we feel that we don't have time to practice, or we don't have time to connect or study, and so we don't really remember what the path is. So we kind of lose our way in that sense. And we just get sucked back into the swirling quality of demands and chaos and just trying to manage. Just trying to manage, just trying to keep it together. Or we could say we have some happiness, some sadness. Kind of a mixture. It's not so bad. Well, you know, from the point of view of the path, it is pretty bad. It actually is going to always lead to further disappointment and pain. Even when you do have pleasure, when you lose it, you complain and you don't feel good about it. And when pain comes, when you get what you don't want, you have further suffering. So there's really no escaping the nature of kind of this conundrum we're in called, we could call it a number of things, we could call it samsara, which literally means a wheel that we keep going around in the same circles, trying to use the same answers to answer the same questions, and we keep falling down and feeling that we missed it again. We didn't get it again. Why does this keep happening to me? Why does my life keep cycling through the same experiences? I thought I was getting better. So by having a path, keeping the path, focusing on the path, doing whatever it takes to really soak yourself in the path, then everything in your life becomes part of that path. And that's really what it means to be fully on a path. Otherwise, you veer off the path, and then you're in the shrubbery, and you've got to get out your machete, right? You become a trailblazer. and you don't know where you are, you're just wailing, you're just cutting things. You're just trying to make it through to the next water hole, to the next relaxed situation. So it's quite profound demand, we could say, to really stay on a path, to have truly a spiritual path, requires a certain amount of real desperation, you could say. That you have to desperately want to see the truth of what's going on. And when we lose that desire to see the truth, we kind of lose our motivation a lot of the time, and then we fall off the path. Now, we could say, from taking a larger view, that part of the path includes falling off the path, fortunately. So we're not, in other words, from that point of view, we're not Methodists or you know, we're not a lot of other religions that say you've sinned and now you're going to go to hell or whatever. We fall off the path all the time. We forget to actually reflect on being present in our daily lives. We forget to meditate because we, instead of actually having a time that we meditate, we left it up to, well, I'll see how I feel, which is the formula for not meditating. I'll see if I'm into it later, and then I'll probably do it. Forget it. You know, you end up usually not doing it. So if you don't have an actual, you structure your life so that you make sure that the path is central, then it becomes so easy to stay on the path if you do that. So one of the famous statements of Chögyam Trungpa, the founder of Shambhala, was that 90% of your problems can be solved with good scheduling.
With good
scheduling.
90% of your problems. So that's assuming that you're a practitioner, of course, you know. That if you can schedule in your practice and schedule in your study and schedule in the Dharma, the path, then it becomes very easy to encompass, for it to begin to encompass your entire life. Doesn't mean you don't have tremendous ups and downs, but those ups and downs become the teachings of waking up, as opposed to those up and downs becoming provocation to solidify a new neurosis, a new kind of way to try to manage, which just never works out in the end. They're always temporary. So if you're on the path, everything that happens eventually becomes the means to liberate yourself. When you don't have a path, it all becomes the means to perpetuate the spinning of confusion. So this is the difference, and you can feel it in one day. In one day. One day, if I don't meditate for one day, I go, something's off. Something's funny. What is it? Everything is starting to feel a little too solid. Well, I forgot that the way to work with my experience is through practice and study. Then everything that happens becomes a kind of a teaching, really, a teaching. And you may not see the teaching right away, especially if you're beginning the path. It seems as though, in the beginning, you may be on the path, but you don't even know what the path is yet. So you're kind of trying to find out what are the boundaries of the path and what does it really mean to be on it. So that takes a while to kind of get your feet, your path feet, you know, your Dharma feet, your journey. But all you have to do, since there's an authentic path, all you have to do is do what they say. We used to call that, there's a famous story in our lineage called the story of the three idiots. And it's a long story, so I'll give you the punchline, basically. The punchline is they're called the idiots because they just do what they're told by their teacher. And because of that, they are highly realized beings. But they're idiots, you know. They don't have to come up with anything brilliant, anything new. They just do what the path says to do, and it leads them to complete awakenment. And so they become Mahasiddhas. So it's just a matter of how one pointedly, you know, it's like becoming a PhD, you know. It's not that you have to be smart to be a PhD. You just have to be really persistent. You know, you have to want it and keep going for it. Eventually, you've got a PhD, right? Unless, you know, something gets in the way. But nonetheless, if you just actually do it, you start to discover that it's doing you. That's the thing. Yeah? You start to do it, you put in the energy, the effort of meditating, studying, hanging out with people who are doing that, just as much as you can. And then, as you're going through your life, you find out that you're being practiced. Your experiences are changing into the Dharma. Until, you know, eventually, you're just living your life, and your life is Dharma. That's eventually. And then you're really helping people, because you're no longer perpetuating confusion for yourself and others. You're just going along, and everything is helpful at that point, because you're not actually in it for yourself. You're in it at that point, you're just in it. And it's just your life. So they say. I'm not pretending to be that person. So, how do we keep that motivation to really be on the path? That becomes a big issue for practitioners, keeping that motivation going. As I said, once you're in the energy of it, it's very easy to keep doing it. I mean, I should say that once you really have a habit of practicing, it becomes easier and easier to do. So how do we motivate? Well, there's a number of elements to that. Number one is what we're doing here tonight. We're talking about the Dharma. We're talking about what is the path. And so we connect with the kind of fresh air that's available to us. The path is all about freshness. It's all about cutting through our habit. And what's behind our habit is actually just what is. It's fresh, it's new in every moment. So that whiff of air kind of wakes us up if we want to wake up, could wake us up. So that's a very important thing what we're doing here tonight, coming and hearing the Dharma and chewing on it and kind of checking it out. Is it true? Is it not true? And then, you know, if you've decided that this is your path, then at some point, you know, you need to actually have a schedule of practice. Now, as I said before, the key thing, you know, someone asked me this the other day, what's the key element of bringing your practice into your everyday life? I think the key element is really that you just do it. You just practice at the same time every day, if you can. It just becomes like you brush your teeth a certain time every day. You don't think, do I want to brush my teeth today? You just do it. And then, brushing your teeth becomes effortless. If you practice every day, practice becomes effortless. That's what you need to do. So first of all, that's very, very important piece. But then, also, you know, we say that it's said in our tradition that if you just practice, you can become a dumb meditator. Just someone who sits and kind of, you know, has some kind of idea in their mind of what the path is, and they're just kind of not challenging their current experience, not challenging, it doesn't challenge the subtler habitual patterns that are coming up for us if we just, you know, read something 5 years ago that we're just kind of riding on that and just sitting. There has to be a sense of challenging our understanding of, you know, what's going on, of actually sharpening our intelligence to where we know the difference between really what is being present and what is some kind of fixated mind. This is a key point. When we can distinguish between those two, what is fixation, that is to say, what is a mind that is actually involved in a habit, habitual pattern, and what is simply being present, simply for present. When we can begin to distinguish between those two, then our path really accelerates. That is the beginning of what we call prajna, or discriminating awareness wisdom, when that begins to happen. That we can see that we're no longer kind of in the dark about, well, I don't really know if I'm really doing it right. We can be temporarily in the dark, but then we get kicked in the butt because we're setting it up that way. We get kicked in the butt in the sense that, you know, some teaching flashes in our mind. We go, whoa, am I missing the point? Whoa, I just realized I'm completely missing the point, because you studied it. And here you are, and it's happening. So that's what study does, is it actually comes up in the moment and points out to you where you might get stuck. And then also other community members become like mirrors to you. You know, spiritual community is actually a very irritating thing. It's highly irritating, because we're not just here to scratch each other's itch and to say, oh, you like that, I like that too. Oh, you like movies, me too. Let's be friends. No, we're in it for reality. We're in it to see what's really going on. So that's rather irritating, because sometimes we don't really want to know what's really going on. We just want friends who feel good. We want someone to feel good with. We don't want to be woken up. So it's all about, this is all about, that you signed your name on the dotted line. You want to be awake? Okay, we're going to wake each other up. We're not going to be mean to each other, but sometimes it feels almost mean when people are reflecting your crap back to you. It can feel uncompassionate sometimes. But really, this is the main point here. Why we have a community, why we're doing what we're doing, is to help each other to freedom and to being able to help others. That's the point. There is no other point here. And of course, the other way that we do that is by creating a society that actually radiates that kind of sanity. And we have teachings on that, and Shambhala teachings are all about how do you create a society that doesn't perpetuate just what we call, you know, kind of the easy, kind of putting you to sleep kind of experiences. Or the, you know, just a, what is a society that perpetuates or uplifts you to where you experience the goodness of your life, experience the appreciation of things, which is also about being awake. As opposed to a society that just wants to make you purchase more ways to feel comfortable. Which is, obviously, if you look around, yes, we're getting better and better at that. You know. So it is, you know, having an authentic path is rare in this world. It's very, very rare. Because it's subtle. The difference between fixating and not fixating becomes more and more subtle the more you work with that. And you know, reality The way things really are is ungraspable. You cannot say, now I've got it. You know, what you've got is an idea about what it is. That's a temporary thing. If you think you've got it, you don't. Guaranteed. Reality is ungraspable. Therefore, the only way to experience it is to have a non-fixated mind, is to not grasp with your mind. Then you begin to understand the ungraspable nature of things. If you're grasping, what you see is, you know, your projection of how things are, not actually how things are. So this is what we're learning. We're learning how to be authentic, how to be genuine, how to be true in each moment. True means that we're not creating just a comfortable reality or even an uncomfortable reality. We do that too, of course, because it's familiar and it's a drama that we believe in. And we believe in certain dramas being true, so we keep somehow finding ourselves in that drama. It's a remarkable thing. We find ourselves in the same dramas over and over again. How could that be if it wasn't us creating it? How could we have the same dramas over and over? It's not possible. It's just that we look for them because we're either afraid of them or we're accustomed to them. So we're already in our own dramas. So the Dharma is actually, it's so boring that we really see how we generate drama. And we start, if we really do practice seriously, you know, you do a dhatam, a month-long intensive practice at some point in your life, if you can, or a week to, and, you know, you just see the same things over and over and over and over and over again. And they become much less interesting, all those stories and dramas that we usually think are the bane of our existence. The fact that this happens over and over is, why does it keep happening to me? And then they just become, oh, I'm doing it again. Look at that, isn't that amazing? And so, consequently, we begin to settle in to a kind of simple earthy reality that has always been there, but that has been covered over by our tremendous struggle to sedate ourselves or to feel that we're okay. So as we begin to settle down, it's just the fog starts to lift and you go, oh. I remember when I lived in New Zealand and I lived down a street. Way off in the distance there were these mountains as I walked down the driveway. I went through a very difficult time when I was there. A kind of a death, kind of a culture shock kind of death. You know, when you don't have your culture and there's no one there to confirm it, you know, to talk to you from the reference points that you're familiar with. So you kind of start to die to your own culture. And it's like a death process. And I remember, you know, walking down that driveway, day after day. And then one day I looked up and I saw those mountains. I went, wait, have those always been there? I saw it. I really saw the mountains. I just, for a moment, was really present. And I saw those mountains. I went, wow, have I been noticing those or not? It was just like that. And I think that's exactly what begins to happen, is that we begin to realize that we are starting to be in our world again. Waking up means we're really in our world in a fresh way each moment, so that we can see what's there, we can taste what's there, and then you've got a life, basically. At that point, you've got a life that isn't particularly nailed down. And that, you know, that kind of spaciousness of things not being nailed down, at first is quite challenging. But we learn to live with that as practitioners. And we learn to actually seek more and more freshness and go beyond our fixated mind, which is just seeking comfort. So I think I've said a lot. Why don't we talk about this? The path. Having a genuine path. Please.
I got a book in the mail just yesterday, and it's by his name's Josh Willis, and he's a really great dietitian and trainer, and he's out of Denver, and he works with weight loss from a habit. It's all habit based, and he takes it in these real small chunks and works on like real small habits at a time. And literally, just before I came here tonight, a quote I wrote down from the book was, good planning trumps willpower every time. And then you said that Chogyam Trungpa quote, and that it's the same. And that's what his plan is all based on. Like, it's, you can say, like, I'm going to have the willpower, but it's good planning, actually, that works way better. Mm. You don't have to worry about your willpower.
Because we tend to be creatures of habit.
Very much so.
And so if you utilize that, you have one really good habit that cuts through all the other habits that aren't helpful.
And it can start with little, you know?
Sure.
And once that's established, then you can move on another one, and it's a little bigger.
That's great,
And a lot of times what we do is jump in all the way, and it's like, all right, I'm going to meditate 3 hours a day. I'm going to, you know? And it's like we want to take on this huge project, and of course we fail, and then nothing kind of comes.
Good point. Yeah, it's a very good point, actually. Very good point. Glad you said that, because I may have given the impression that you just got to sort of soak yourself right now, completely in it, in order to do it properly. But actually, you know, there's an absorption rate of some kind, you know, and you do have to begin and sort of pay attention to really, you know, starting with small steps, small pieces. So we say, you know, just practice 10 minutes a day, 15 minutes a day. That's it in the beginning. That's enough. Gradually you can extend that. Very good. Thank you.
Roland, I have a question.
Yeah.
You said something at the very beginning that ties in, I think, with something you mentioned more toward the end. When you described enlightenment as, or waking up, or freedom, as being able to really see things as they really are.
Mm-hmm.
So, does that, and can you say more about how does that tie in with this beginning to see how we are fixated and identifying with the things that are happening? I'm curious to hear a little more about how it is that once we really see as things that are happening, and we have, because I keep getting the sense that I'm noticing in my own practice that there's a space that's coming.
Yeah.
And then that space I take in the world, so that as things are, off the cushion, I should say, so as things are appearing to happen or whatever, things repeating themselves and seeing my response and feeling all that and just being with it, it's so uncomfortable, by the way. Like, you know, you talk about that absorption of it. It's very pain. It's very uncomfortable a lot of times for me right now. But is the freedom tied in with, or is the awakening tied in with this idea of not fixating? And is that something that's going to arise as a result? I'm trusting that's something.
Exactly.
And my sense is that non-fixation will arise as the more that we do this practice. And that space that I'm talking about.
That's a very good question. I think you said it. You actually said it. That's right. The basic experience of being alive is so basic and unconditional. We call it basic goodness. That we usually miss it. And we're more focused on the dramas and the ways that we're going to feel better, or the ways that we're going to make something happen the way we want it to go, that we miss the very simple realities of breathing and being alive. So it is, you're right, it is something that happens in glimpses, actually. Little glimpses happen. That you'll just be going through your day, and all of a sudden you'll realize that you lost track of the drama that you were in. It just happens. And I remember one of the first times that happened to me in a noticeable way. I was a salesman at the time in the North Shore of Boston. And it was a horrible job. It was a really hard job. Door-to-door businesses, just cold calling restaurants mostly and things like that. And I remember just feeling like, how am I going to make a living doing this? And I stopped for lunch and I went. It was a beautiful, it was an area called Marblehead, which is just out by the sea. Gorgeous area. And I sat there on a bench and I totally forgot my anxiety for a moment. And then I went, wait a minute, that's right, that's what I was thinking about. And I found my anxiety and I went right back to it, you know? And then because I was a practitioner, I saw what I did. And I realized that's what you do, that's what I do. You know, you have that moment of just being present, and then, but you're not used to that. That's the thing, you see, it's new. We're not used to just being in open space, undefined, just present.
And that seems to grow.
That's right, our tolerance for that, that's right, grows. Until the whole thing flips at some point, and you actually, your whole allegiance flips towards openness. So actually at some point, the whole thing flips and you're really much more, when it shuts down, you notice, wow, where did my wakefulness, what happened? What did I, you know, where did it go? And you might have to just sort of stop.
Can wakefulness and
and
suffering coincide?
Of course, sure, I mean, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so.
I thought so.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, you know, there's a wonderful...
It does feel really good sometimes, but there's also can be a lot of pain.
That's right. That's right. Yes, indeed. So, yeah, I mean, there's a famous sort of formula about that, which is that, you know, pain times resistance equals suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's right. So what we're learning here is the ways that we try to fix the problem, try to not feel pain, turn out to be the struggle that perpetuates pain. And so learning to be with it as it is, you know, you actually start to see what it's made of. And it's not less painful necessarily, but it becomes, again, a journey forward of wisdom, a journey of actually further opening. So it can become very poignantly painful, rather than painful in a way that you just want it to stop.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
It's like a sensation too, right, sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without any stories.
Exactly. Exactly. So in fact, it's said in our tradition that the ideal state of a human being, the ideal kind of awake state in terms of your emotional experience, is a sort of bittersweet.
Great.
That's the actual quality of the awakened heart. It's bittersweet. It's not just happy.
All the time it's bittersweet?
There's always a sense of...
like rawness.
Of rawness, that's right.
Yeah.
There's always that sense of rawness. Mm.
Is that the heart of sadness?
That's right.
Yeah, because it seems like when I get down to it, it just is a great... I have a great sense of sadness.
Yes.
And that's the bitter part of it.
Well, you know, sometimes the sadness sometimes triggers our habitual relationship with the sadness, doesn't it? So the difference between the genuine heart of sadness and our usual experience of sadness, there's a difference there. So that the genuine heart of sadness, there's a kind of open, unknown openness to it. That doesn't, you're not sad about something. You're not being punished. There's not a feeling of something's wrong, I'm sad. It's actually a feeling that I'm sad and that's how the heart is. It's good. It's a good sadness. Mm-hmm. It's a full sad joy. It's a full sadness.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's said that that's because part of the reason for that is that you can never fully share your heart with anyone. your experience is always, when it comes down to it, is always your own, fundamentally. So you're alone with your world and your experience. So there's a sense always of a kind of aloneness, a loneliness. Not loneliness. Loneliness eventually becomes aloneness, which is actually kind of fearlessness, kind of power, energy in it, or truth in it. So I think there's famous stories about great meditators who, you know, they sing these songs of sadness and loneliness. But then later, you know, they sing these songs of realization, which also have that quality, but it's a different tone. So there's a journey you take with everything, including your sadness. There's a journey you take with your suffering, right? It's part of the path. It's a journey.
I love discovering the Dharma years ago, coming from Christian fundamentalism. And then I found over the years I had turned it into Buddhist fundamentalism, that Buddhists were better than other people, that I didn't date non-Buddhists, associate. Right. It's part of a checklist on Match.com or Dharma Match. And so listening to you talk about the path tonight, it's like I have found to widen that path and try to see where authentic Christianity or, a fitness path, that there's room for all of those, that the Buddha works through everything, that they would say. And I wouldn't give up the sitting practice, but I certainly think that a relationship can be tremendously a practice. And the Tibetan tradition, I don't know much teachings on that. Some of Trungpa's students, like John Wellwood, has done a lot about relationship as practice. Even, 12-step can be used mindfully.
Sure.
There's a 12-step on money neurosis that is has been very valuable to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering what you think about that balance of keeping our practice pure, but also not being fundamentalist about it.
Right, exactly. Well, I think you said it. On the other hand, there's this... interesting. I think as a practitioner who really is serious about wanting to be on the path, if you're really serious about that, then you have to see that everyone is in the same boat. We're all in the same boat, regardless of whether you're a Buddhist or somebody else, we're all in the same boat. And so the more you work with your own mind, the more you see that. Now, the interesting thing is that it might also be true that, especially in the beginning of the path, that you need a lot of support. So it's different in the beginning, I think, than it is later on. That's my experience.
Yeah.
That in the beginning, you might need to be a little more fundamentalist in order to establish your practice. Or else you just get sucked in back into your with friends who just want you to be your good old self. Hey, what's with this stuff? Get off of it, man. I know who you are. I know that you love to drink or love to do this or love to do that. Come on. Get back in. Jump in. You're our friend. So then, they're setting up a thing where, you're rejecting them for doing what you're doing. Or sometimes you feel like your family might be doing that. I used to feel like when I'd go home to Thanksgiving, that everyone was challenging me as being a Buddhist. They were challenging it over and over again. And it was kind of like, come on, you're still you, dude. I know your buttons. You think you're on a path. Well, let's see. Let's see if it's really doing you any good. It's that kind of, being maybe a little bit threatened by the possibility of someone not holding the place that you think that they should have in a family, you know, that you're changing. You know, a lot of relationships, people get into the relationship because there's a certain dynamic they like. If someone starts to change, you feel maybe like, hey, you're not holding up your end of the deal. You know, you're not supposed to change. So I think so long as there is that kind of appreciation of change, as long as you're both interested in growing, then I don't think it matters what the path is, so long as you can allow for each other's change, right? And in fact, you know, I know people who have partners that are not practitioners who are encouraging them to go practice because they like them so much better when they're practicing than when they're not.
Yes.
I know lots of people with situations like that, so that they become their biggest kind of, you know, kick in the butt. It's, you need to go practice, you know. So there is that too.
I have a little Buddhist joke that I made up. Mm. So, you know, there's a dating service called Great Expectations. Well, the Buddhists decided to set up theirs, and guess what they called it?
No expectations. Yeah.
But I think families are a great measure of how you're doing.
It's true.
When you go back to your family and, you know, they start pushing the buttons, and, because it's very easy to just go back to what it was like.
Oh,
so, yeah, it's a good measure.
Well, everyone expects you to be the same.
Yeah.
It is great. I mean, I learned myself personally the way to survive in that situation, because my family was very competitive. And so the way to survive it was to develop a really good sense of humor. And I never would take it seriously, the jabs, and I'd just go, oh, you know. Your guess is as good as mine, you know. So, and then gradually people just appreciate that, hey, you've cheered up a bit. That's good. Eventually people act. That's a really interesting point, really, is that I once had this dinner with my mother who, you know, was always kind of criticizing my Buddhist connection, my Dharma connection, because she felt that it in some way undermined my drive, my competitiveness. And maybe she was right in a certain way. But anyway, so she was always very critical of that. And then one night, way later on, many years later, I was having dinner with her alone in a restaurant, and she had had a few wines. And she turned to me and she said, you know, I don't know what it is, but when I'm with you, I feel peaceful. And you know, that was it. That was the message. That in spite of whatever she had been saying and the messages she'd been giving me, something was helping, something was getting through. And it just shows that your manifestation in the world, if you can do it, helps people automatically, whether they admit it or not.
I went to... Go ahead. This is a different topic if yours was...
No, mine's different too.
So here's the question.
Yeah.
Let's say that one has strayed from practice and life has become catastrophic. Mm-hmm. Unbelievably so. Mm-hmm. So along with returning to practice, would there be a particular text or something that would remind one of the basics again, so that there could be some sense of at least being on the road to solution?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. The thing is, you know, the wonderful thing about practice is having practiced in the past, you know, it doesn't take that long to start to appreciate again the virtues, the helpfulness of beginning to practice again. And also, you start to realize that life is the meat in your sandwich. All that stuff that happens to you actually becomes the means of wisdom on your path. Every single thing that happens to you, regardless how crazy it is or painful it is, it's actually what you how you discover the nature of things is through that. So none of it's wasted. And I think, you know, a great thing to read, there's a lot of things to read that actually are about that. I mean, depends, you know, I would want to meet with you to maybe talk about, or meet with the person beside you.
It is me.
Yeah.
I
had that feeling. I'd be happy to meet with you and talk about maybe, you know, what the nature of what's going on is and what might be a good thing to read. But like for... But for some people, I mean, one of the greatest all-around great things to read about difficult situations, bringing that to the path, is Milarepa. One of the great realized beings. Have you heard of Milarepa?
I used to have a copy.
Yeah, because Milarepa, you know, I mean, what's more extreme than becoming a murderer and being completely miserable and having been betrayed by your aunt and uncle and blah, 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 on and on and on. And yeah, really heavy duty stuff. And he killed a whole bunch of people and he was ready to kill himself. He was so miserable. And then, you know, he began to practice the Dharma and used all of that. All of that was utilized as his, you know, he was a really good black magician.
Is that the name of the book?
Milarepa. Well, there's The Life of Milarepa, is the usual, where you follow the story, and then there are the songs of Milarepa, 100,000 songs of Milarepa.
I know I've like read things about him, but is there a book in particular that talks
about
his life?
Yeah, there is. The Life of Milarepa, I would recommend the Lalungpa translation, is really wonderful. Lalungpa. But anyway, we could meet and talk about what's going on. But yeah, that's an amazing, it's an amazingly encouraging thing to read. If you feel like you're, you know, there's no hope for you or something. And then the other one that for me made a huge difference, I went through actually quite a deep depression in my early 20s, a very serious time for me. And I found Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind to be one of the greatest books because it keeps pointing out that you already are the Buddha. You don't have to improve. You are the Buddha now. The moment you take the seat, you're taking the seat as the Buddha. You're just simply what's the word he uses?
Reassuming.
He doesn't use that word, but it's similar. You're assuming your Buddha nature when you take the posture. That's it. You don't have to do anything else. And there's something about that that has truth in it that you can feel if you can gain confidence in that. And he says it in so many different ways that you can't help but gain some confidence in it by reading that book. So I think it's a wonderful book for that purpose. And then Pema Chodron is extraordinarily helpful when going through difficult times.
Isn't there a book called Living the Great Catastrophe?
Yeah, that's Simmer, what's not Simmer, Zinn. Zinn?
Yeah.
Zinn? No, what's his name?
John Kabat-Zinn.
John Kabat-Zinn. And that's, that's probably good too. I think for someone who's already a practitioner, that's more for someone who's doing it through the other approach, not particularly, you know, they're doing it through the approach of mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a little, you know, I mean, similar. It's a good gateway, but you've already received a lot more than that if you're on the path, in my opinion.
Yeah. Do you have something you want to say? We're going to have to...
Oh, no, I was just going to say I went to this lecture on Tuesday night. I don't know if anybody knew about it, the Francisco Varela lecture series, and they were talking about neuroscience and contemplative life, and that the studies they've been doing on great meditators, and they worked with the Dalai Lama, is that, I mean, being on the path does totally change your brain. And so they were just talking about well-being and the inherent goodness that they, with studies they did on babies.
Sure.
And how they would love to bring meditation into schools and everything, that it could change the whole everything. So it just does show that to keep the practice up.
Exactly.
There was a famous study where they did, where they gave the teachers of elementary school kids training in MBSR, and the kids' grades got better. That was like really interesting.
Oh, they trained the teachers.
Trained the teachers, and then the kids' scores improved. So the scientists were like, oh, that's interesting.
I didn't say very much about it.
Stress reduction for teachers.
I didn't say very much about it, but I do think that one thing I said about the bigger perspective of the path is it includes falling off the path, and that's a big part of the path, in fact. So I didn't say that much about it, but that's a whole other talk about, you know, how to actually work with coming closer, coming further. That's what we tend to do. We get into it, we pull back. So not to view that as some kind of sin or being, you know, a big problem. It's how what we do as we progress on the path. And gradually it becomes easier and easier to kind of give in. It's a kind of giving in.
I think big crux is like when you, like I have been meditating long enough and practiced long enough now that I see it. It's very distinct the way my mind works. Like I can almost predict it on a daily basis, like the cycles I'm going to go through and stuff. And one of the cruxes is the more you see it, it's so easy to like dislike yourself for it, because it's just like, I see it coming, like here it comes.
Yep.
And then it's just so easy to go to like, oh wow, you know, like how can you keep doing this? And then I think that's just a whole other layer of bullshit.
Yeah, I think also, you know, some of us, you know, there are those of us who really flourish or flower in more of a group. And there are those of us that flourish alone. Mm-hmm. And you have to know which one of those you are. It really helps. Because if you are one of those people that requires group energy, then if you're just alone all the time, you can really, you know, kind of lose your momentum or lose your focus. Yeah. So anyway, we should stop.
Quick announcements. Next Thursday is the next day, right? So